No one stormed Parliament Hill. No one went in there and with any guns ablazing. No one threatened any politician.
The gate doing 98 as us let them truckers roll 10-4.
Cause we got a mighty convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a mighty convoy. Ain't she a beautiful sight? Come on,
hello, everyone. Welcome to the next episode of Beneath the Law. My name's Gavin Tai, here with my good friend, colleague, co-host, Stephen Teal. Stephen, boy, have we got a honking episode for people today.
Yeah, very loud horns.
Yeah. Honk, honk, here we go, down the convoy trail.
It's keeping me awake. I got that mighty convoy song in my head. Just going to keep on
okay,
trucking along.
Okay, good buddy, 10-4. So,
over and out, any beers in the air?
Yeah, well, listen, don't be talking like that or you're going to get your bank account frozen. So the latest legal bombshell to hit the airwaves and the... jurisprudence is, of course, the recent decision out of the federal court on the challenge to the constitutionality and legality of the federal government's decision to invoke the Emergencies Act in response to the, well, you can call it anything you want, the trucker convoy, the freedom convoy, the anti-vaxxer party. It depends on your perspective. What you want to refer to this as, but really one of the, probably the most, as far as I can recall, the most overt display, if you will, of civil disobedience that I can recall in Canadian history, really ever, you don't really think of Canadians and Canadian politics as being particularly revolutionary. We didn't have a Tea Party in Hudson Bay, and we weren't born of revolution. We were born of compromise and discussion as a nation. I think that that has sort of permeated our politics throughout our history. And this probably was the largest gathering of dissenting voices in one place who were amplified through the honking of their horns in Ottawa and otherwise. That really did create quite the scene, if you will, for the federal government, very close to the home of the federal government. And the response of the federal government here in Canada could not have been more strong and could not have been more forceful in terms of Canadian law and legislation. So we had probably the biggest outburst of civil disobedience, met by, in my opinion, the strongest and most, frankly, totalitarian response that our government has at its disposal. What do you think?
It was certainly the loudest protest probably in Canadian history, and it took place on the doorstep of our federal government, right outside of the Parliament building in Ottawa. You're right, I guess, Gavin, with respect to history. The only three incidents that I guess come to my mind in terms of civil disobedience are the FLQ crisis back in the late 1960s, 1970s, where the War Measures Act was invoked by then Pierre Elliott Trudeau, father of our current prime minister. Probably the Winnipeg strike in 1910-1911 was a act of civil disobedience. And in terms of the early days of the forming of Canada, the Louis Riel, what they call rebellion, was probably, certainly the most violent part of Canadian history from a disobedience standpoint. And of course, Louis Riel is seen as a hero by many, certainly from the Métis Nation. It's not just a legal issue, it's a real political issue. And, the truckers in Canada were certainly impacted by the vaccine mandates, the change in crossing the border. They decided to, take that issue to the Canadian people, organized a protest using their vehicles in many parts of Canada, or I guess in some parts of Canada, let's say not many, because it really wasn't all over Canada, but there were, I guess, five or six locations where there were blockades. And the most visible of those ended up being in the nation's capital, where they, sat their trucks on the streets in front of Parliament Hill for about 3 or 4 weeks and decided to use their horns, their voices to protest against the vaccine mandates that had been implemented and, that were causing about, 15% of Canadian truck drivers the potential inability to earn an income.
Yeah, I think before we get into it, I do think that you've mentioned the FLQ crisis, which was the first time, and I think the only time, that the predecessor to our current Emergencies Act was ever invoked by our federal government. And well, one thing about the FLQ crisis, as I recall, it was that it was marked by some fairly dramatic, violent episodes, including kidnappings, murders, bombings. So it was truly a armed and violent insurrection, if I can use that word, and a terrorist movement. Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly there was terrorism, what we would term terrorism today, involved. There was, there were bombs in mailboxes. I believe Minister of Labor in Quebec, Pierre Laporte, his body was found in the back of a trunk. He was murdered. So there was actual violence. There was actual criminal activity that took place in, one of Canada's largest provinces. And it was certainly, I suppose, unknown at that time. I was very young. You were very young. Probably not watching the news at that point in time. I studied the FLQ crisis a little bit in university. But there were acts of violence there, and there were acts of criminality, and I think it was unknown whether that would extend beyond the province of Quebec.
Well, I mean, I think that the name of it sort of tells the tale. It was very much a revolutionary movement with a group in Quebec who wanted to separate by force and create an independent state of Quebec, separate and apart from Canada. And it was very much a revolutionary movement within Canada that was resorting to violence to achieve its ends. Is that fair? And I don't know that you can really compare. Certainly, I don't think there is any evidence or that I've seen that there was any real violence, and certainly an organized movement on the part of the truckers to disrupt or attack Canadian sovereignty and to create a new nation or to have a revolution, an armed revolution, within Canada. So I don't know that there's really much of a comparison between the FLQ crisis and the trucker situation in Ottawa in terms of A, the violence that was utilized, and B, the objectives of the movement, which was not to really attack Canada as such. It was just to voice fairly aggressively disagreement with a policy of the government.
No, and I agree with that. Look, I think there were incidents of isolated incidents of violence, but not very many. There were certainly individuals or other residents in Ottawa who were shouted at and that kind of thing, but certainly there was nobody that was being kidnapped or murdered or beaten up. There were no politicians whose lives were in danger. The only incident that I'm aware of is that in Coutts, Alberta, the convoy there or the blockade there did have weapons, I guess, in one of the vehicles, and the RCMP went in and they dealt with it.
Yeah, I think that that's really probably, to my mind, the biggest issue is that the Ottawa situation, while probably the worst and the biggest, was not the only situation across Canada where there were groups of protesters, truckers, who were blockading or they were parking vehicles in such a way. Let me just stop there for a second. You know, that seems to me, and this is just my recollection, to be kind of a tried and true method of protest, particularly by truckers. And I can think of farmers. I can think of a few times where truckers, for example, took up three lanes of the, or the all the lanes of the highway on the 401 and traveled at 15 kilometers an hour and blockaded the whole highway. I can recall one instance when that happened. I can also recall of instances where farmers who were unhappy with a policy of the Ontario government rolled trucks and tractors through the streets of downtown Toronto, particularly around Queen's Park, and completely snarled up traffic all through downtown Toronto. So that's not an uncommon method. But in regards to the protests against the vaccine mandates, etc., during the pandemic, we had incidences in Windsor and we had incidences in Alberta that appear to have been dealt with without resorting to what is the Canadian equivalent of martial law, which was utilized in Ottawa. How did that work?
Well, and, you know, my own view on this, Gavin, is that the Ottawa situation was entirely bungled. In that respect, the best example that contrasts what happened in Ottawa is what happened at the Windsor Bridge, where the municipal government immediately, upon the blockade, put together an application for an injunction to keep that bridge open. And they went to court and they got an order to remove the truckers and the people who were protesting on the bridge and blockading the bridge give access to that bridge. There are laws in place, of course, whether they're provincial laws or municipal bylaws. You cannot blockade a roadway. Plain and simple.
Well, that's always been my, the where I kind of, I'm lost on this. If I parked my car on a busy street, we're in downtown Toronto, if I just left my car there for the day, blocking a lane of traffic, I would probably come back and not find my car there by the end of the day. Or if I wanted to sit in it and block a lane of traffic in a no-stopping zone, for example, I probably would be towed out of that position. I mean, aren't there municipal bylaws that govern where you can park a vehicle?
Yeah, one would certainly think. I mean, you know, it's as I say, I'm boggled by it. It's mind-boggling. I'm troubled that the municipal government in Ottawa didn't really do anything. And, you know, perhaps it was a poor police response to the entire situation. It's not like anybody didn't know that the truckers were coming to Ottawa to protest. And, you know, at the end of the day, my recollection of this entire protest was that the organizers simply wanted to meet with government and have their views heard, and the federal government refused to even have a meeting with them.
Yeah, I mean, another fact that I understand to be the case that has been gotten very little airplay that I've heard in mainstream media is at the time that the Emergencies Act was invoked, the time that the equivalent of martial law was declared, my understanding is that a good percentage of the trucks were actually leaving, and that they had agreed, for example, to move off of the residential streets surrounding the Capital area. Those trucks had actually left, and there was, in the process of dismantling what would be the gridlock that they had created. I mean, it's hard to get a truck out of there when you've got 15 trucks in front of it. But there was a process in place where this blockade was de-escalating and in the process of moving itself out of the vicinity. And as you mentioned, there had been no effort or no attempt at all to have any dialogue with these protesters. You know, is that the kind of situation that you immediately go to martial law to resolve?
Well, one would not think so. Look, my other recollection, and I think it's not talked about either, is that the residents, or at least one resident in Ottawa, was forced to bring their own application to court for an injunction, which you know was pending to be heard at the time, right, to remove the trucks because they were causing a nuisance to the people who lived in the downtown core. And it's unfortunate that our government actually placed that individual in the position where they had to hire a lawyer and seek relief.
Right. I mean, so what we've got, I think, is that we've got examples in other parts of the country where similar situations, albeit in fairness, smaller situations, were resolved using existing legal frameworks, be it injunctions, orders, mandatory orders of that were enforced and or basic municipal law in terms of where you can park your vehicle and noise. Frankly, there are lots of municipal ordinances against excessive noise and whatnot. But in Ottawa, the federal government saw fit to basically pull out the what I can only call the nuclear weapon in the federal arsenal of peacekeeping, suspension of all of the usual safeguards, including the charter rights of people, to remove this blockade in Ottawa. And that was the subject of the application by a number of applicants, including the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, that this was an improper use of the emergency powers and the Emergencies Act. And that ruling came down very recently.
Right. excuse me. You know, part of the use of the Emergency Act is, you know, the threshold question there is that there's a threat to the security of Canada. And in the reasoning, this is a very lengthy judgment. Not surprised that it's going to appeal to Federal Court of Appeal. You know, the judge speaks to the issue of other laws being in place that could have dealt with this protest rather than the federal government needing to invoke the Emergencies Act or, as you say, roll out the nuclear weapon from the legislative arsenal of the federal government. And that plays a significant feature in the decision that the use of the act was unreasonable and, as the judge says, ultra vires of the federal government.
Yeah, let's just pause parenthetically there, because I think that if you're listening to this podcast and you are of the view that the trucker protest was a bunch of yahoos who you didn't agree with what they were advocating for, some of it was a little off the wall, I agree. But, you know, I step back from that for a minute, and this is always something that I'm always concerned about as sort of as a citizen, certainly as a lawyer, is that you can't pick the group to which you want rights to apply because you like them. I mean, there's a whole series of what are rights all about. And rights are, at their core, fundamentally, have to be about something more than I agree with you and therefore you have rights. I mean, rights must transcend what you think about what somebody else has to say. I mean, there's a great saying that, you know, freedom is not about the things you love, it's about the things you hate. And that's the truth of the matter is that you don't need a freedom of speech, for example, to say something that everybody's going to applaud and agree with. You need freedom of speech to be able to say things that people are going to disagree with and not particularly like. That's why you need to have that right protected, because if it was just something everybody agreed with, then what would you need a right for?
I agree. Look, it's always interesting. Let's face it, the left wing I'm going to be political here. The left wing is great at organizing protests, and nobody says a word. They march down the streets. We've seen it a number of times, certainly in Toronto, where they organize. They take up University Avenue, one of the main streets in Toronto, blockade the street with, you know, hundreds of people, and march in downtown's core and create, what I'll call a nuisance, right? They require drivers to go elsewhere. People don't want to go downtown. No one says anything. Those protests are allowed to happen. Here, the truckers who are advocating against a liberal government with respect to the vaccine mandate basically express their views. They don't do it in a violent way either. I mean, if you take a look at the insurrection that happened in Washington, no one stormed Parliament Hill. No one went in there and with any guns ablazing. No one threatened any politician, right? They didn't cause any destruction. There was no real property damage done to Parliament Hill, as far as I'm aware of. But because they were a right-wing group, we had the government invoke the most extreme piece of legislation that it could against them. And you know what? It just didn't impact the people who were organizers and who were parking their trucks on the street. It impacted people, peaceful protesters, who were just simply holding up signs and wanting to join this protest and have their voices heard with respect to the mandates that had been imposed during the COVID-19 crisis.
Well, I think it went further than that. My understanding is, of people that weren't even there. So, I mean, I will say this. This is just anecdotal, but I had the good fortune of being in Europe shortly after all of this occurred. And I can't tell you how many people that I spoke to there who had completely unprovoked on, and just in conversation, on hearing that I was from Canada, said, "Wow, what's going on in Canada? What's happened to your country? And I found it pretty defensive about Canada, pretty patriotic and proud to be Canadian. But it really blemished, I think, in fairness, the Canada's identity on the world stage as a truly a beacon of democracy and freedom, where if it can be suspended that easily and government can come in with force, with using armed force to suspend civil liberties, to freeze bank accounts of people who disagree with the government. I mean, these are the kind of measures that you would expect out of a tin pot dictatorship like Venezuela or something of that nature. And it really, if that was something, well, I agree with that point. I mean, I think you need to step back thinking about this, because really, what happens when governments change and what happens if a government comes along that you don't agree with? And all of a sudden you want to be the one out protesting about something. And the government says, people can't say things to say they disagree with the government, because if they do, we're going to invoke the Emergencies Act. We're going to freeze their bank accounts. We're going to arrest them. We got people, for example, who are still in jail after being arrested in regards to the Freedom Convoy or the Trucker Convoy or whatever you want to call it issue, and have spent that entire time in custody. I mean, you got to turn it around and say, if you can't have freedom to say what you think, because the government in power doesn't like it, that could be reversed pretty easily, and you can be on the other side of that.
For sure. Look, I spoke to Richard last week, and by the way, a shout out to you, Richard, for your comments, positive comments about our podcast. But he and I had a discussion about this, and expressing fear of having your bank account seized for, let's say, merely giving a $10 donation in support of a cause that you feel is important to raise is a scary thing. Right? Like the bank is basically shutting down your bank account. You can't go and buy food. You can't go pay your rent. That is so extreme. And
now let's talk about that in another context. And, you know, that is as extreme as it gets. We have a Charter of Rights here in Canada that purportedly enshrines rights, and every law that offends that is unlawful. It is supposed to be the supreme law of the country. The Emergency Act, by definition, suspends charter rights. I mean, there is all of these things that occur immediately without the need for it. And there may be situations where, you know, the niceties of due process and that type of thing have to be suspended. If the country is invaded, for example, by a foreign power, and you've got to really have martial law in order to organize. You can't be tiptoeing around while you're trying to defend yourself against an invading force. But it's serious business when you suspend all of the rights and freedoms that are enshrined in the Charter. I mean, by analogy, I mean, there's been great hue and cry when the notwithstanding clause, which is enshrined in the Charter, which allows Parliament to invoke laws that would potentially offend the Charter, and notwithstanding the Charter. But one of the things that occurs with that is, of course, is that governments have a life cycle. Well, most governments have a life cycle of a 4-year life cycle. So they got to come back for re-election, and baked right into the Charter is that when there's another election, that has to be those laws that have invoked the notwithstanding clause have to be revisited to see if the new government wants to continue it along. So there's a democratic check, if you will, in regards to this. In the Emergencies Act, they pull the trigger, they do the whatever they need to do to basically whatever they want to do, and the only check is a what I call coroner's inquest after the fact to look into, gee whiz, well, we have to have an inquest as to whether or not this was appropriate. And of course, there was such an inquest here, and the inquest basically left the notion of whether the invocation of the Emergency Act was lawful to the federal court, which has now come back and said it was not lawful.
Right, and the judge who held that inquiry specifically said that. Now, I think in that judge's view, it was a little bit more closer to the line in terms of the way a ruling would have been made in terms of the appropriateness of invoking the Emergencies Act. But that issue is left to the courts, and that's how the judicial review came about.
Right. So now here we're in a situation where, I think that the government set a new world record for running to the podium to say they were going to appeal the decision. Maybe we could get them on the bobsled team, because they were pretty quick to run over there. But anyway, they were quickly saying they were running to the federal court immediately to appeal this decision. I mean, one wonders why. So what? I mean, the truth is the Emergencies Act was invoked. The damage is done. Courts come along now and said that was unlawful. I mean, Stephen, what remedy is there really for people who were injured by this unlawful use of the government power?
And so the remedy exists under the Charter. Section 24.1 of the Charter permits a remedy for someone's rights being breached. That remedy is a damages remedy. A court can award a monetary award against the person that breached the Charter rights, which in this case, of course, is government. So now they've put the taxpayers on the hook for this. I don't know how many people are impacted specifically by what happened. But, you know, one could muse that, is this a potential class action against the federal government? And how much taxpayer money now is going to go out the door because of this misuse right now, as found by the court, of this Emergencies Act power? So the federal government has no other choice, in my view, Gavin, but to appeal this decision, because the Canadian taxpayer may be footing the bill at the end of the day for the breach of charter rights because somebody decided to take their protest and let their voices be heard. You know, from a political perspective, let's face it, the ruling federal government has egg on its face once again with respect to having invoked the power for a government that always talks about people being allowed to express themselves. They were the one who pulled out the sledgehammer.
Right. Their tolerance wasn't very, was kind of intolerant for those who disagree with them. But anyways, you're quite right. I think at the end of the piece, this it's ironic, if you will, because the argument of the federal government was that the danger to Canada was primarily economic, in the sense that there was this blockade was costing a fortune in terms of dealing with. And now we've got the not only the cost of the blockade itself, we've got the cost of the implementation of the Emergencies Act, which was, I suspect, no small line item on the budget. And now we have the prospect that there will be significant damages awarded to those who were unlawfully injured by the misuse of the statute. We'll see what the federal court has to say. I suspect that this won't be the last conversation we're going to be having about this fairly momentous event in Canadian legal history, and certainly one that put us on the world stage, and I'm going to suggest for all the wrong reasons.
Well, let's face it, Gavin, before we wind up here, this case is going to land in the Supreme Court of Canada, regardless of which way the Federal Court of Appeal rules. That's where it's going.
100%. And in fairness, I can't think of an issue of greater national importance than the ability of the federal government to suspend the rights of citizens in this country, and out of what circumstances would warrant that invocation of such extreme power. That's truly an issue of national importance.
100%.
Well, Stephen, another interesting and...
say it, exciting episode.
It was honkerific. Anyways, we will look forward to our next episode. I hope you tune in and join and download it wherever you download your podcasts. Hope that you found this an interesting debate. Always pleased to hear from anyone else on the other side of the equation with comments, criticisms. And if you disagree with us, I promise we won't freeze your bank account. So once again, always remember that if no one is above the law, then everyone is beneath it, except when the Emergency Act is declared.